Hello and welcome to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Today we're reading from vanityfair.com. We've got current events. We're checking in on the royals. We've got stuff happening in Hollywood, of course, politics and the Best Levin Report. We are going to start in the vanities section, which is current events and things that people are talking about. For example, you may have heard of the banana art that was sold at Sotheby's this week. This is the $6.2 million banana explained. Comedian Maurizio Catalan's instant classic sold for more than quadruple some estimates at Sotheby's this week. How one work and its worth both satirizes and explains the meme-y days ahead. This is by Nate Freeman on November 22nd. In November 2019, Paraton Gallery announced that Maurizio Catalan, the art world's reigning prankster provocateur, had made his first new work for an art fair in 15 years. It was called Comedian. Maurizio Catalan is known for hyper-realistic sculptures that lampoon popular culture and offer a wry commentary on society, power, and authority, the gallery said in a press release that went largely unnoticed at first. Comprised of a real banana affixed to the wall with a piece of gray scotch tape, this new work is no different. In the same vein as Catalan's America from 2016, this piece offers valuable insight into how we assign worth and what kind of objects we value. The statement explained that Catalan spent a year trying to make a sculpture of a banana. He tried resin, then bronze, then painted bronze, before finally coming back to the initial idea of a real banana. When Emmanuel Paraton's gallery first taped a banana to the wall of its booth at Art Basel Miami Beach on December 4th of that year, actually using duct tape for the record, it was an immediate sensation among those at the first choice preview. Comedian became the most Instagrammed work at the world's most Instagrammable art fair as two editions quickly sold for $120,000 before Paraton reportedly texted the artist and asked if he could up the price to $150,000. There was also immediate outrage that someone could just tape a banana to a wall, call it art, and sell it for six figures. Somebody came up and ate the banana at the fair in protest. The gallery just replaced it. The certificate accompanying the work says that the banana can be replaced at any point, and they had a backup banana. And then the New York Post put the work on its cover, ensuring its immortality. "Bananas! Art world gone mad," read the Wood. The 5 years later, that $150,000 price now seems downright modest. On Wednesday night at Sotheby's in New York, seven bidders chased Comedian well past its $1.5 million high estimate, until a client on the phone with Sotheby's Deputy Asia Chair, Jen Hua, offered a bid of $5.2 million, which came to $6.2 million in fees, shocking the packed sales room. How did we get here to a point where a 35-cent banana taped to a wall sells for the price of the most expensive house in Cleveland? Let's take a step back. When I first got the Paraton review for the Art Basel Miami Beach in 2019 and saw Comedian, it struck me as an archetypal work by the artist, a very high-level Catalan, and the price of $120,000 seemed kind of reasonable, maybe even a bargain. Catalan's auction record is $17.2 million. That would be for a statue called Him, which is a tiny Hitler, and several of his pre-Comedian ready-mades have sold in the seven figures. Daddy Daddy, a Pinocchio toy lying face down in a pool of water, sold for $1.2 million. Ostrich, which is just a taxidermy ostrich, sold for 1.5 million British pounds. This is a new artwork by an artist who semi-retired after his Guggenheim retrospective in 2011, and it's a particularly striking one. the juxtaposition of the industrial-grade duct tape and the ripening soft yellow flesh of the banana is super punk rock and kind of unforgettable. It nods to one of my personal favorite Catalan works, A Perfect Day, in which he duct taped his dealer, Massimo DiCarlo, to the wall of his gallery and kept him aloft the entire day of the opening. And the subversive nature of using a biodegradable medium like a banana didn't strike me as too challenging in a world where Urs Fischer's untitled Bread House, a house made of bread, could be offered at Art Basel for $3 million. Bread rots, too. The Guggenheim Bilbao changes the flowers on Jeff Koons' puppy twice a year, but it's still always Jeff Koons' puppy. Comedian is deeply engaged with art historical movements, in line with the Dadaist principles of Duchamp ready-made, mixed with the ephemeral nature of instruction-based conceptualism. The owner of the work does not receive a banana or duct tape. They get a 14-page manual that specifies how to tape the banana and where to put it on the wall, along with a certificate of authenticity. Anyway, it was an immediate sensation, and the three editions sold instantly. Sarah Andelman, the founder of the now-defunct Paris fashion boutique Colette, was the first buyer, and reports at the time said that a Frenchman bought the second edition. Another edition was bought by the Miami-based collectors Billy and Beatrice Cox. In the years that ensued, the banana kept popping up. Even Damien Hirst said he wanted one so badly he offered Catalan any of his artworks if he agreed to trade his AP. Catalan said no. The Guggenheim announced that an anonymous buyer had donated an edition of the work to the collection. The Coxes have said they intend to donate the work to an institution. The family did not immediately respond to a request for comment. It was shown at the UCCA in Beijing, at the Palazzo Bonaparte in Rome, and at the Leung Museum of Art in Seoul in 2023, where, once again, it got eaten. It's still the last work of art to appear on the cover of the New York Post and arguably the most famous artwork made this century. It created such a sensation that lasted and is still lasting into the present of the world in general. Francesco Bonomi, the former Venice Biennale curator and one of the world's great Catalan experts, said in an interview with Henny in 2021, "He created a sign that went beyond the border of the art world and invaded the collective imagination of the world." Then in October, Sotheby's announced that it would be selling an edition of Comedian at auction for the estimate of between $1 million and $1.5 million. According to Sotheby's provenance, the gallery White Cube had acquired the work from one of the original buyers, and this new owner had consigned the work to be sold. Everything was taken incredibly seriously. Comedian was installed at Sotheby's in a chapel. Catalan's Comedian represents the apex of a 100-year-long intellectual yet irreverent interrogation of contemporary art's limits, read the unsmiling wall text. In a slumping art market where shows with deafening hype go half-sold and masterpieces get zero bids at auction, there was every reason to think that Comedian, which is, again, literally a banana taped to a wall, would fail to meet the $1 million reserve. But the lot was guaranteed by the house, ensuring it would sell. Rumor even had it that the house had turned down offers of third-party guarantees in the $2 million range. Sotheby's declined to comment. In the lead-up to the sale, I crowdsourced a question: how much will the banana sell for? The results were shocking. Very smart people told me this thing could sell in the range of $3 to $4 million. One auction maven made an even wilder bet, $9 million. On the seventh floor of Sotheby's headquarters Wednesday night, the vibe was a little different from most auctions I've been to. Sure, there was the crush of advisors and dealers grabbing catalogs and starting to schmooze, but I spotted way, way more guys in Ami Leon Doré hats than usual. People were wearing sneakers, and not those $1,000 sneakers from The Row. Those are an auction house staple, but like Jordans. Michael Eisner was there, probably not to bid on the banana, but it seems right to point out that the former head of the Mouse House was in attendance for this most Hollywood of events. After a few lots, before auctioneer Oliver Barker opened bidding on the comedian, he mentioned something that close readers of the catalog had already noticed. Cryptocurrency payments would be accepted on this lot. This seemed like a reverse in policy, as the whole NFT Bitcoin stuff had been a bit sidelined since the Web3 insanity crashed around 2022. But if you haven't noticed, Donald Trump got elected president thanks to meme lord and mega-rich person Elon Musk, who will run a new government agency called DOGE. Yes, the name is called back to Dogecoin, a forgotten meme coin that is currently peaking. Actually, all crypto seems to be peaking, which means there might be more people willing to spend their hard-speculated currency on some wacky conceptual art. Once the formalities were dispensed with, Barker opened at $800,000, chandelier bidding up at $100,000 increments. A collector in the room offered $1.3 million and was quickly beat out by two different phone bidders on the horn with Sotheby's specialists, a potential buyer online, and a group of collectors battling it out from the middle of the row. That crew, actually wearing t-shirts emblazoned with images of the duct-taped banana, chased the beast until $2.4 million. At that point, the bidder on the phone was Hua. Jousting with an online client, going back and forth, trading lobs and pushing the price higher and higher. First 4.8, then 4.9, and then, these are words I never thought I'd say. $5 million for a banana, said Barker. It's one expensive banana joke. This is it. Don't let it slip away. Suddenly, the online bidder came in at $5.1 million, forcing Hua back up to $5.2. It's slipping through the auction room at $5.2 million, Barker said. That was a last banana joke. The gavel slammed down. With the buyer's premium, the price went up to $6.2 million. Applause rippled through the room, and a bunch of Sotheby's staffers with martinis and Negronis suddenly materialized. One staffer told me that the collector on the phone with Hua had come forward. It was Justin Sun, the wealthy founder of the cryptocurrency Tron, which is currently trading near its peak. No surprise there, really. For years, Sun was held up as the future of art collectors, someone who splashed out equally on the old-school art masters, $78 million for a Giacometti sculpture, $20 million for a Picasso, and a new school masters, Beeple, Pak, all those kind of guys. He was reportedly watching the sale from his apartment in Hong Kong, where he plans to install the work, according to Bloomberg. Naturally, he took the auction house at its word and told Bloomberg he's considering paying in crypto. This is not just an artwork. It represents a cultural phenomenon that bridges the worlds of art, memes, and cryptocurrency community, Sun said in a statement. I believe this piece will inspire more thought and discussion in the future and will become part of history. I'm honored to be the proud owner of this iconic work and look forward to it sparking further inspiration and impact for art enthusiasts around the world. He added that in the coming days, I will personally eat the banana as part of this unique artistic experience, honoring its place in both art, history, and popular culture. I'm not really sure there is a right price. There's just a right price right now, said Art Intelligence Global founding partner and former Sotheby's rainmaker Amy Capolazzo when asked if Comedian is worth $6.2 million. It just depends on the level of liquidity. Just as the artwork lampooned and reflected the pre-pandemic excess of Art Basel Miami Beach in 2019, it speaks to this moment as well and probably will continue to, just as Duchamp's shovel can still shock 100 years later. The banana is the disciple of the shovel, Capolazzo added, and then stepped into an elevator to leave. I reached out to Bonomi, who was not in New York but followed the sale from Italy. He said that it would be a mistake to read too much into the price paid, given the elastic nature of cryptocurrencies. The entire thing is kind of a theatrical fiction. It could have been $100 million, he said. It doesn't add anything to the radical nature of the work. In fact, it diminishes it, because now you think about the price and not the brilliant radical gesture. The reaction in the room was nothing compared to the outside world. I posted a story to Instagram and immediately had dozens of aghast responders, desperate to know how a $6.2 million banana was possible. To many, it was the first hinge moment of the second Trump presidency, one in which the mind-boggling amount of money sloshing around, in crypto and otherwise, can make the absolutely impossible commonplace, the mundane miraculous, and the 35-cent banana Scion's trophy. The following day, Sun only further cemented the moment with a post on X of an illustration of a giant banana duct-taped to a spaceship. "I'm willing to donate my banana to Elon Musk. Tape it to the body of a SpaceX rocket and send it both to Mars and the moon," Sun said. Our next headline is defying AMC. Theaters ban Wicked fans from singing during the movie. This is by Eve Beatty on November 23rd. Not even Wicked is immune from the 2020's tendency to turn everything into a possible fight. The hotly anticipated theatrical adaptation of the blockbuster Broadway musical opened in theaters this weekend, with stars Cynthia Erivo and Ariana Grande thrilling audiences with their renditions of songs such as Defying Gravity. That the experience is so transcendent is raising concerns, however. Fears that some patrons might break into song are prompting extreme preemptive measures to keep everyone's lips zipped. Singing along with the film has always been encouraged at special participatory screenings or the midnight ritual known as the Rocky Horror Picture Show, but the recent rise of the so-called demon scream at concerts, in which patrons drown out headliners by shrieking over the singers they've paid to see, has worried some that the behavior could spread to smaller scale venues. A popular 21-year-old musical such as Wicked seems perhaps like a target-rich environment. AMC, the world's largest movie theater chain, decided to get ahead of any disruptions by posting signs about movie etiquette that have been widely shared on social media. "To our guests seeing Wicked, we ask that you allow everyone to enjoy the cinema experience," they read. "Please refrain from singing during the show." The printed out signs join a message played before the movie which says, "At AMC theaters, silence is golden. No talking, no texting, no singing, no wailing, no flirting, and absolutely no name calling. Enjoy the magic of movies." According to AMC spokesperson Ryan Noonan, announcing these policies is all that stands between Oz and mayhem. "AMC has a long-standing policy that prohibits disruptive behavior," he told the Indianapolis Star. "The Wicked pre-show spot incorporates the themes of the film as a fun, engaging reminder to moviegoers to not disrupt the experience for those around them as they enjoy the show." It's unclear if Noonan has ever attended a movie at his place of business, as his company's texting and talking prohibitions are as studiously observed as the booze rules at an average Big Ten university's dorm. The Chicago Sun-Times critic Richard Roper voiced support of AMC's guidance, tweeting, "Unless it's a special sing-along event, you should be the one to wait to stream it so you can sing to your heart's content at home, rather than ruining the experience for everyone else at the theater. They're paying to hear Cynthia Erivo and Ariana Grande, not you." Illinois special education teacher Ariane Tyler was so concerned about the threat of unapproved songbirds that she, per the Wall Street Journal, rented out a theater for a private viewing, even creating a Facebook group to communicate the rules of the event. "Bathroom breaks, loud chewing, and costumes are verboten, but harshest words are for singers. Unless you have won a Tony," she wrote, "no singing will be permitted. I'm so serious when I talk about these rules," Tyler told the WSJ, "so serious, in fact, that her children, aged 8 and 5, will not be allowed to attend the evening. She can't trust them not to sing," she says. If all this sounds tiresomely rigid or like an act of war on fun, theaters have a special Christmas gift just for you. Variety reported earlier this week that starting on December 25th, around 1,000 theaters across North America will host interactive showings of the film. If you need to break out in song a bit sooner, Elphaba and Glinda might give you a pass, even if your fellow patrons won't. In a recent interview, Erivo, who plays Elphaba, said, "If you come the first time and you sing through, sing through. But come a second time and let us sing to you. We understand if you sing, Grande," Glinda says. "We respect the feelings, but if someone throws popcorn at you, their phone, or something, maybe stop." Our next headline, Jelly Roll, fresh off Prince Harry's tattoo, gets personal on CMA's red carpet. This is by Erin Vanderhoof on November 24th. Fresh off of an Invictus Games collaboration with Prince Harry, country star Jelly Roll took the stage at the Country Music Association Awards in Nashville on Wednesday night. The singer, born Jason DeFord, joined Brooks and Dunn on stage for a rendition of their 2005 song, Believe, to perform his new single, Liar. On the red carpet before his performance, DeFord mentioned that he was feeling so nervous about the night during dress rehearsals. "I got so overwhelmed with what was happening," he said. "I'm afraid it's going to happen again when I walk out there." Though DeFord, who won New Artist of the Year in 2023, was nominated for 3 CMA Awards, he went home without a trophy on Wednesday, though he did get a different keepsake out of the evening. The singer was on the cover of this week's issue of People magazine, and when reporters presented him with a physical copy, he noticed that his new friend was featured in the magazine's corner. "They just put out a thing with me and him," DeFord said. "Who would have thought that I'd be on the cover of something and the Duke of Sussex would be in the corner of that cover? This is unreal. I am honored." In the cover interview, DeFord spoke about committing himself to weight loss, mentioning that he had lost about 110 pounds so far this year by running and addressing what he described as a food addiction. "I've never had a healthy relationship with food, so that was the hard part," he said. "But once you get into that discipline and commitment, it's like an avalanche. Once that little snowball started rolling, it was on its way." On Tuesday, Harry's Invictus Foundation announced that the rapper-turned-country crooner would headline the February 2025 Invictus Games closing ceremony in Vancouver. The news came out in the form of a comedic video where DeFord gives the Duke a tattoo of the Invictus Game, I Am logo, and a Jelly Roll signature. In a conversation with People, the tattoo artist who co-starred in the spot discussed the pair's immediate chemistry. "Jelly is fearless, and Harry knew it had to be epic, so they had a true moment where they both knew where it had to go after all the jokes," said Josh Lord, the owner of the Eastside Inc. in Manhattan. "Here we are, a room full of people who have seen some things, but Harry was probably the bravest and funniest of all of us, really. Behind the scenes, he's got comedic chops that I didn't expect." Lord added that Harry's squeal when the needle touches his neck happened on the first take. "Luckily, I have a long history with fake tattoos, and they hadn't originally planned for that part of it," he said, "so I was able to provide a small level of assistance." In other royal news, King Charles' $91 million coronation has enraged the British public. This is by Erin Vanderhoof, published on November 22nd. When Britain celebrated the coronation of King Charles III and Queen Camilla in May of 2023, the ancient ceremony came along with a ceremonial parade and days of celebration around the nation. On Thursday, the UK government announced that the festivities cost 72 million British pounds, or about $91 million, a sum that has raised eyebrows amid the country's ongoing economic doldrums. In their annual report for the fiscal year that ran from March 2023 to March 2024, the UK Department for Culture, Media and Sport broke down their annual budget of 7.9 billion British pounds, which is about $9.9 billion, and shared that approximately 50 million British pounds went toward the coronation weekend. The Home Office spent a further 22 million British pounds, or about $28 million, on policing for the events. The department's costs included the Westminster Abbey ceremony and associated programming across the weekend, including the Windsor Castle concert featuring Lionel Richie, Katy Perry, and a 300-person choir comprised of regular Britons, a day of big coronation lunches across the nation, and a day of community service which saw Prince William and Kate Middleton join in with their 3 children, Prince George, Princess Charlotte, and Prince Louis. Further support for the events came from the Sovereign Grant, the public money given to the royals in exchange for their public duties and the proceeds from their historic property holdings. In their annual report released in August, the Crown Estate shared that they spent 1.4 million British pounds, or about $1.8 million, on the coronation weekend over the course of 2 fiscal years. Soon after Charles began his reign in September 2022, palace aides told Vanity Fair that the king wanted to stage a scaled-back coronation to avoid excessive public expense. But by December, then-Prime Minister Rishi Sunak had announced that the weekend would include an extra bank holiday in the country, directing his cabinet to ensure the event showcased the best of Britain. In their report, the DCMS justified the expense of the once-in-a-generation moment by pointing to its global impact. The coronation weekend provided an occasion for the entire country to come together in celebration and offered a unique opportunity to celebrate and strengthen our national identity and showcase the UK to the world, the report read. The coronation achieved more than 100,000 news stories and reached an estimated global audience of 2 billion people in 125 countries. The report noted that the coronation reached more survey participants among the G20 nations than any other event put on by the department. Graham Smith, CEO of anti-monarchy advocacy group Republic, believes that the sum put forward by the DCMS understates the true cost to the government. "I would be very surprised if the £72 million was the whole cost," he told The Guardian. "It's a huge amount of money to spend on one person's parade when there was no obligation whatsoever in the Constitution or in law to have a coronation, and when we are facing cuts to essential services." We're going to move on to a movie review. Why Denzel Washington's Gladiator 2 performance is so unexpected and brilliant. This is by David Canfield on November 22nd. We've reached the point where Denzel Washington is such a giant movie star that when he makes a movie, it's more likely than not to be named after his character. He played Roman J. Israel, Esquire. He's always the Equalizer. He saw the dagger in the tragedy of Macbeth. Like the biggest A-listers of his generation, the man knows how to keep you glued to a screen for 2 hours and has built a filmography off of that reputation. There may not be a more dominant, charismatic presence in American movies than Washington, and that's been true for decades. Which is precisely what makes Washington's work in Gladiator 2 so fascinating. This is ostensibly not Washington's movie, and yet he inevitably, overwhelmingly assumes control of the Ridley Scott epic long before its climactic clash. For the most part, Scott returned to familiar sets, themes, and archetypes for his decades-in-the-making sequel, from Paul Mescal stepping into Russell Crowe's anguished shoes to Fred Hechinger and Joseph Quinn trading flamboyant Joaquin Phoenix homages. The film feels so in conversation with its predecessor, down to literal grainy callbacks, that it feels like far too much of a retread without a true disruptor. The smartest decision Scott could have made was to call on Washington, his American gangster star, to bring that chaos. Gladiator 2 pushes the action forward decades from where the first film left off, when Maximus, played by Crowe, died on the Colosseum floor, while his lover, Lucia, played by Connie Nielsen, and son, Lucius, Spencer Treat Clark, faced an uncertain future. Played by Mescal in the sequel, an adult and seemingly orphaned Lucius is our focus after he's taken prisoner by the Roman army and forced, like his father, to fight as a gladiator. Upon arrival in the Eternal City, he finds his mother partnered with his captor, the Roman general Arcatius, played by Pedro Pascal, and also meets an enigmatic arms dealer, Macrinus, played by Washington, who takes an interest in mentoring him for the ring. These threads gradually converge in classic twists of betrayal and ambition, and all roads seem to lead toward Macrinus's Machiavellian plot to control Rome. I'm going to pause here to remind you that you're listening to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. We are in the middle of a movie review about Denzel Washington's Gladiator 2. Let's continue. Though his aims aren't exactly hidden from view, Scott does not spell out Macrinus's intentions or his methods, only his backstory as a former slave who's learned how to navigate a corrupt and cruel system. Washington does the work from there. He portrays Macrinus with irresistible swagger. He wields a joyous, toothy grin like a deadly curse and spins stuffy, classical dialogue with a jarring, colloquial ease. These choices, smashing through period trappings with a modern brio, recall Washington's subtly searing take on Macbeth from just a few years ago. Only here, they serve an original and more outwardly villainous character. We watch one of the great living Shakespearean performers apply that specific skill to a role he can sculpt as he goes, one that holds no expectations or rules. Macrinus comes into view as the man pulling all the strings, and with Washington playing him so cheekily from moment one, the narrative gambit proves easy to buy. This effect underlines the freedom that comes with a supporting role, the sort of part we haven't seen Washington take on, at least not with this much relish, in quite some time. Rather than matching the movie's broadly brooding aesthetic, he fights it. As Mescal trudges through a melodrama of legacy and retribution, Washington briskly glides through a black comedy of manipulation. Where most of Gladiator II lacks sexuality, Washington comes off like a mischievous, horny flirt with eyes on every babe and hunk in his orbit. The character is openly bisexual. Washington recently revealed that he filmed a gay kiss that didn't make the film's final edit, but what survives in the theatrical cut, at least, makes such a scene fairly easy to imagine, and all the more disappointing to have been denied. Washington has been nominated for 6 acting Oscars in the 21st century, all for lead performances. You'd have to go all the way back to 1990 to find the last time he was recognized for a supporting turn for his electric work in the Civil War drama Glory. He won that Oscar, his first of 2, and in the years since, Washington mostly stayed at the top of the call sheet. He emerged as the face of more movie posters than we can count, anchoring prestige dramas and action blockbusters in equal measure. Early awards buzz is circling Washington's work in Gladiator II, and he's got a shot at winning his 3rd and maybe last Academy Award in the category where he started, as he drops hints about his retirement from acting, discussing what he'd like his last big jobs on screen and stage to look like. Gladiator II's positioning on Washington's Hollywood arc feels gratifying, even moving. It's both a return to the explosive, engrossing spontaneity that made him a star in the first place, and evidence of just how high that star has risen. Washington may not be the hero in Gladiator II, he may be the villain, in fact, but we can't help root for him. He's taught us well. Here's our segue into the politics section. Ellen DeGeneres and Portia de Rossi get the hell out of the U.S. because of Trump. This is by Casey Wickman on November 21st. Ellen DeGeneres and Portia de Rossi have said goodbye to all that and relocated from their primary home in Montecito, California, to the United Kingdom's rural but ritzy Cotswolds region, according to a report Wednesday in The Wrap. The couple, who wed in 2008, reportedly told Friends that the move was motivated by the re-election of Donald Trump for a second term as president, and that they do not have plans to return to the United States. Their Montecito property will reportedly be sold. Of course, DeGeneres has also suffered a years-long fall from grace in the public eye after reports of the comedian creating a toxic environment on the set of her long-running talk show. Even Kevin Hart calling her one of the dopest people on the fucking planet couldn't stop DeGeneres from, in her words, being kicked out of showbiz. The Ellen Show ended in 2022 after 19 seasons on air, and in a July 2024 audience Q&A after a performance of her Ellen's Last Stand Up tour, she said that she was quitting showbiz entirely. "This is the last time you're going to see me," she said. "After my Netflix special, I'm done." Said special, For Your Approval, hit Netflix in late September, and that apparently is that. She did reveal in the special that she had started raising her own chickens, which seems like a fitting hobby for life in the Cotswolds. The couple, who renewed their wedding vows in February 2023 with a little help from officiant Kris Jenner, with Montecito neighbors Prince Harry and Meghan Markle among their guests, have already been spotted out and about in their new region. An Instagram video shared last week showed the two at a pub with friends, including singers Natalie Imbruglia and James Blunt, taking in a live acoustic performance by The Corrs. DeGeneres supported Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris and shared her endorsement in August via Instagram, writing, "There's nothing more powerful than a woman whose time has come. I can't wait for @KamalaHarris to be our new president." Sources told TMZ that the couple had snapped up their UK property before the election, but that they were very disillusioned after Trump's win and decided it was time to get the hell out. Representatives for Ellen DeGeneres and Portia de Rossi did not immediately return Vanity Fair's request for comment. Our first headline in the politics section, Nancy Mace's Capitol bathroom bill is a reprise of 2024 election fear-mongering. This is by Eric Lutz on November 20th. Republican Representative Nancy Mace said Tuesday that she was absolutely targeting her incoming colleague, Democrat Sarah McBride, with the anti-transgender bathroom bill she introduced earlier this week. Mace, an ally of Donald Trump, introduced a resolution Monday prohibiting members, officers, and employees of the House from using single-sex facilities other than those corresponding to their biological sex at the Capitol. She framed the measure, which she wants included in the rules package for the next Congress, as a matter of women's security. When asked Tuesday if she introduced it specifically in response to McBride, who won her race for the House this year, becoming the first openly transgender person elected to Congress, Mace said, "Yes, and absolutely, and then some." McBride, a Delaware Democrat, was already the highest-ranking transgender elected official in the country, serving as a state senator. Her historic victory this month also came in an election in which Republicans ran on an aggressively anti-transgender agenda. Trump's campaign even ran ads against Kamala Harris with the language, "Kamala is for they, them. President Trump is for you." Shortly after the election, McBride reacted to Trump making his opposition to rights for transgender people a centerpiece of his campaign, telling NPR that the president-elect clearly spent a lot of money scapegoating and fear-mongering around a very small and vulnerable segment of our country. "I think the reality is that we're going to see attacks on freedom for so many vulnerable people across this country," McBride said, "and it's going to be our job in Congress to defend the rights and to defend the freedoms of all the people that we represent." This week in Washington is orientation for new members of Congress, and Republicans have already continued to target transgender rights. What they're talking about there on day one is where one member out of 435 is going to use the bathroom, said Representative Catherine Clark, a Democrat. That is their focus. Mace, in particular, has occupied herself by attacking McBride, but of course she's not the only Republican doing so. Marjorie Taylor Greene reportedly threatened to fight McBride if she used the women's bathroom at the Capitol. "It's pretty aggressive for biological men to be invading our spaces," Greene told Politico. House Speaker Mike Johnson hasn't publicly taken a stand on the resolution, telling reporters Tuesday that this is an unprecedented matter, so we're going to find a resolution that solves the problem. While he said he will accommodate the needs of every single person, Mace told Axios she had Johnson's support, and even more moderate Republicans indicated they would back the measure. "I mean, a presidential election may have been decided on this issue," a one House Republican told the outlet. Several prominent Democrats have called out Mace for her proposal. McBride Monday condemned the resolution as a blatant attempt from far right-wing extremists to distract from the fact that they have no real solutions to what Americans are facing. "Delawareans sent me here to make the American dream more affordable and accessible," she said, "and that's what I'm focused on." Our next headline, the Trump dance craze signals a MAGA shift in the NFL. This is by Tom Clute, published on November 21st. In September of 2017, about 8 months into the first presidency of Donald Trump, I attended a game between the Tampa Bay Buccaneers and my beloved Minnesota Vikings. This particular NFL Sunday, like so many days back then, was both subsumed and suffocated by the first-term president. That weekend, Trump had launched a series of broadsides at the country's most popular sports league. He ripped Colin Kaepernick and other players who kneeled during the playing of the national anthem to protest racial injustice and police brutality, calling on NFL owners to get rid of anyone who disrespects the flag. Trump asserted that such demonstrations were why the league's television ratings had dipped. The NFL responded forcefully, determined to present a unified front. Roger Goodell, the league's commissioner, criticized Trump's divisive comments, while current and former players took turns bashing the president on Twitter. The feud put the NFL slate on a knife's edge, with fans and media paying an unusual amount of attention to pregame activities. At the game I attended, two members of the Buccaneers knelt, while the hometown Vikings stood with their arms locked. "Thank you for standing," yelled one woman in my vicinity. Dozens of players around the league took a knee that Sunday, with many teams joined by their owners for the anthem ceremonies in a show of solidarity. When he started to attack the players, the league, the business itself, that forced everybody to unify, says Malcolm Jenkins, a retired NFL safety who was in the vanguard of the NFL's Trump-era activism. A Super Bowl champion with both the New Orleans Saints and Philadelphia Eagles, Jenkins raised his fist during the national anthem, much like the iconic Black Power salute by Tommy Smith and John Carlos at the 1968 Olympics. You had every owner in the NFL suddenly behind their players. Even Jerry Jones is down on a knee after that. He forced their hand to pick a side, essentially, Jenkins recalls. The moment epitomized Trump's contentious relationship with the NFL throughout his first term. The tradition of presidents hosting championship teams at the White House had long been a fairly low-stakes ritual, but became a source of political acrimony after Trump took office. In February 2017, several members of the Super Bowl-winning New England Patriots declined to join their teammates at the White House. Later that year, on the same September weekend that he picked a fight with the NFL, Trump announced that he was withdrawing a White House invitation to the reigning NBA champion Golden State Warriors after the team's star, Steph Curry, said he would prefer not to go. After winning a Super Bowl with the Eagles in 2018, Jenkins said immediately that he didn't plan to visit the White House. Several other players said the same. The day before he was scheduled to host the Eagles, Trump disinvited the team because, as he wrote on Twitter, only a small number of players decided to come, and noted in a White House statement that he believed the Eagles disagreed with their president because he insists that they proudly stand for the national anthem, hand on heart, in honor of the great men and women of our military and the people of our country. Those 4 years were typified by Trump's frequent attacks on American athletes, including LeBron James and Megan Rapinoe. So it was not hard not to contrast all of that with last Sunday, less than 2 weeks after the 2024 election, as a very different gesture appeared on the NFL playing field. After touchdowns and sacks, one player after another celebrated by mimicking Trump's signature dance. The move, an awkward mix of fist pumps and hip shimmies, is familiar to anyone who has taken in one of Trump's rallies where he's known to bust it out dancing during YMCA by the village people. Recently, it's become a recurring sight on the gridiron, performed by professional and collegiate players alike. West Virginia University quarterback Nico Marchiol did it after finding pay dirt against Cincinnati earlier this month, prompting Trump to share a clip on social media. Nick Bosa, the star defensive end for the San Francisco 49ers, offered his own interpretation of the move after recording a sack against the Buccaneers in one of their first games after the election. One day after he drew a fine for brandishing a Make America Great Again cap while crashing a live post-game television interview. Last weekend, however, ratified the Trump dance as a full-fledged trend. UFC heavyweight champion John Jones celebrated his victory at Madison Square Garden on Saturday with his rendition of the move, as Trump looked on from his ringside seat. Several NFL players performed the dance the following day, including Las Vegas Raiders rookie tight end Brock Bowers, who credited Jones for the inspiration. Then, on Monday, U.S. soccer star Christian Pulisic made the move following a goal in the national team's win over Jamaica. A dance does not necessarily amount to a political endorsement. Pulisic, for his part, said he did it because he thought it was funny. And with nearly 1,700 players on active rosters, the NFL runs the ideological gamut. But the league, much like the country, looks different than it did 8 years ago, with outspoken players such as Jenkins retiring and giving way to a new generation. The league replenishes its talent pool every year with a slew of new players in their early and mid-20s, an age group that swung hard toward Trump in this year's election. In the wake of Trump's victory on Election Day, the most politically active players may also sound different than they did in his first presidency. The Trump dance is taking over sports, the sport commentator Clay Travis, an outspoken supporter of Trump, wrote on X. Pray for the left-wing sports media who have spent the past 8 years telling you Trump was Hitler. They have been utterly destroyed. Trump World is embracing the on-field celebrations. Caroline Levitt, a Trump Vance transition spokeswoman, said in a statement, President Trump is the people's president, and that is why he won both the Electoral College and the popular vote. The silent majority is confidently showing their support for President Trump and his vision to make America great again. Jenkins put it a little differently. As he sees it, there's now a different player at the microphone than when he was still playing. Back then, the loudest players were those who were disgruntled with the system, who were pushing for a particular agenda to get changed, he says. I think you're starting to see those players come to the forefront who have always been supportive of Trump's politics and him as a person. They're starting to come out of the woodwork a little bit now, and it's safe for them to do that. The NFL said they have no issue with players using the Trump dance on the field. Players, per NFL rules, are allowed to celebrate in any way that doesn't include violent or sexually suggestive acts, but are not permitted to wear hats or clothing that promote political opinions on the field after a game. So apparently the league doesn't consider the Trump dance to be a political statement. In the next 4 years, Jenkins doesn't expect as much strife surrounding the White House visits either. As long as Trump doesn't pick a fight with the NFL between now and then, I think they'll resume going back to it, he says. But if he were a member of this season's Super Bowl champion, Jenkins' own answer would be the same. I would still decline, he says. Jenkins admits to feeling disappointed last Sunday as he watched current players shimmy like Trump. The dance, Jenkins acknowledges, makes him cringe, even if it was meant to be funny. I think it's concerning that athletes at this point in time don't seem to completely understand the power of their influence and voice, he says. We are moving to the first of the 11 reports for this week. The first headline, Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy's cutting-edge idea for shrinking the budget. Fire everyone who doesn't want to work in the office 5 days a week. This is on November 21st. When Donald Trump announced that he was putting Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy in charge of his administration's newly formed Department of Government Efficiency, he boldly claimed the initiative, under the duo's tutelage, would become the Manhattan Project of our time. And a week and a half later, it's become abundantly clear that the analogy is less about the smartest people in the world coming together to build something that will fundamentally alter life as we know it, than it is about two guys indiscriminately dropping a bomb on America without actually thinking through the consequences. The first clue came on Wednesday when the op-ed for The Wall Street Journal, Musk and Ramaswamy revealed that their big idea to cut government waste and shrink the federal budget was to make everyone come into the office and fire those who refuse. Requiring federal employees to come to the office 5 days a week would result in a wave of voluntary terminations that we welcome, the two wrote. If federal employees don't want to show up, American taxpayers shouldn't pay them for the COVID-era privilege of staying home. Should federal employees be required to come into the office a few days a week? Maybe. Is having a blanket rule that says if they don't come in every day, they'll be fired a smart idea? Probably not, at least when it comes to retaining people who actually know what they're doing and could easily find work elsewhere should the terms of their employment with the federal government become pointlessly draconian. As NBC News notes, the Biden administration ordered federal agencies in 2023 to substantially increase meaningful in-person work, but it also left some flexibility in place, citing operational costs like office space, the need to recruit top talent, and other factors. An August report from the Office of Management and Budget showed approximately 1.1 million federal or civilian employees, or nearly half the workforce, are eligible for working from home at least part of the week, with an additional 280,000 in fully remote positions, meaning under Musk and Ramaswamy's proposal, more than 1 million people, should they choose to say no to working in the office 5 days a week, could be canned. If you're wondering if the RTO edict floated by Team Trump is anything new for Musk, it's not. In 2022, he ordered Tesla and SpaceX employees to report to the office for a minimum of 40 hours a week, though, according to CNBC, 3 months after the fact, Tesla did not have enough room or resources to bring all of its employees back to the office. In other DOGE news, last week the group called on high IQ small government revolutionaries willing to work 80-plus hours a week to do so for free. Our next headline, Matt Gaetz withdraws from Attorney General consideration over quote-unquote distraction of sexual misconduct accusations. This is on November 21st. Matt Gaetz announced Thursday that he was dropping out of the running to become Donald Trump's Attorney General, saying the confirmation process had become a distraction. In a statement, the former congressman said that while he felt the momentum was strong, it had become clear that my confirmation was unfairly becoming a distraction to the critical work of the Trump-Vance transition, writing that there is no time to waste on a needlessly protracted Washington scuffle and that Trump's DOJ must be in place and ready on day one. Gaetz said he would be withdrawing his name from consideration. He added, I remain fully committed to see that Donald J. Trump is the most successful president in history. I will forever be honored that President Trump nominated me to lead the Department of Justice, and I'm certain he will save America. The distraction in question, of course, pertains to the allegations that Gaetz had paid women for sex and had sex with a minor. While a Justice Department investigation into the matter had been dropped, the House Committee on Ethics had conducted its own probe into the accusations, and it was set to release a report on its findings before Trump nominated Gaetz to serve as Attorney General. At that point, Gaetz resigned from Congress, and it appeared the report would not see the light of day. On Wednesday, the ethics panel voted against releasing it. Since Gaetz was nominated to run the Justice Department, a number of details concerning what the Ethics Committee was told have emerged. According to a lawyer representing two women who spoke to the House panel, Gaetz had allegedly paid them $10,000 for, among other things, sex. One of those women had reportedly told the panel that she saw Gaetz having sex with a 17-year-old. Gaetz has denied all of these accusations against him. It's not clear what happens to the longtime Trump ally now. Obviously, he can't just take away his resignation notice. According to state law, a special election must be held to fill his now vacant seat in Congress. Presumably, Gaetz could enter that election, but it also seems possible that Trump will give him a position that does not require Senate confirmation. Before Gaetz dropped out of the running, Trump seemed intent on ramming his nominations through, whether or not the individuals in question were qualified for the jobs, having demanded the Senate allow him to make recess appointments. On Wednesday, Senator Lindsey Graham urged his colleagues to not join the lynch mob against Gaetz, saying they should give the confirmation process a chance to move forward. Our next headline, Trump continues to troll America, nominates wrestling executive to lead the Department of Education. Linda McMahon, come on down. In the 2 weeks since Donald Trump was re-elected president, he's tapped a string of individuals to serve as second-term advisors and cabinet members, whose common thread could be summed up by four words. What the actual fuck? Trump wants to put a rabid anti-vaxxer in charge of the nation's health, named a man accused of having sex with a minor as attorney general, and picked a former real-world cast member to run the transportation department. Now, unsurprisingly, he's decided a person best known as a wrestling executive should preside over the Department of Education. Yes, on Tuesday night, Trump announced that he had named former longtime World Wrestling Entertainment president and CEO, Linda McMahon, as his pick for education secretary, saying that McMahon will make America number one in education in the world by sending education back to the states. Trump has previously pledged to dismantle the Department of Education, and while it seems unlikely that he'll actually be able to do so, he can certainly use his cabinet pick to attempt to hack away at the agency through budget cuts and other measures. As for McMahon, her credentials to run the Department of Education are unsurprisingly scant. As the Washington Post notes, in 2009, she once claimed to have earned a degree in education, but shocker, that wasn't actually true. Meanwhile, like any Trump nominee worth their salt, she has been associated with at least one sex scandal. Per New York Magazine, in October, Linda and her husband, Vince McMahon, were sued in a Maryland civil court by five former ring boys, basically gophers, who claimed that they had been abused by a former announcer and that the McMahons had hired him despite having knowledge of his alleged conduct. The unnamed plaintiffs were as young as 12 when they were allegedly abused by announcer Mel Phillips, who died in 2012. Phillips was fired in 1988, but rehired 6 weeks later with the stipulation that he stop abusing children at work, according to Business Insider. He was fired for good in 1990 after more alleged incidents of abuse. Vince and Linda returned Phillips to the organization with the caveat that Mel steer clear of underage boys, stop hanging around kids, and stop chasing after kids, said a witness in a 1992 defamation suit related to the incident. The McMahons and WWE have denied all wrongdoing. Linda stepped down from her executive position at WWE in 2009 to run for Senate in Connecticut, resulting in unsuccessful bids in 2010 and 2012. For his part, Vince McMahon has been personally accused of sexual misconduct and infidelity numerous times. In 2022, the Wall Street Journal reported that McMahon had paid out more than $12 million over 16 years to keep allegations against him quiet. 2 years later, a former staffer filed suit against McMahon, claiming he'd offered her a job for sex and allegedly trafficked her to other men. The lawsuit has since been paused because prosecutors are investigating the trafficking allegation. McMahon has denied all the allegations. In other cabinet news, Trump on Tuesday named Dr. Mehmet Oz, long known for peddling health misinformation and snake oil, as his pick for administrator of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, while Cantor Fitzgerald CEO Howard Lutnick, who has embraced Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s anti-vaccine stance, was tapped for Commerce Secretary. We're going to end with a short article from the Awards Insider. The Governor's Awards deliver an emotional tribute to Quincy Jones. This is by Rebecca Ford. The Academy of Motion Pictures, Arts, and Sciences annual Governor's Award presentation is often a favorite event for Hollywood insiders, as it allows industry icons who have been otherwise overlooked for Oscars to finally get their due. The event, which is not televised, has a warm and leisurely pace, giving the honorees and those who are honoring them time to properly look back on their careers and thank the many people who got them on that stage. This year's gala, held on Sunday, November 17th in a packed ballroom in Hollywood, was more emotional than in other years because Quincy Jones, the iconic music producer whose film scores include In the Heat of the Night, In Cold Blood, The Wiz, and The Color Purple, had died 2 weeks before the ceremony was set to take place. His family took the stage to accept the award in his honor, delivering a touching tribute. "In some ways, it was a difficult decision for our family to be here tonight," said his daughter, Rashida Jones, "but we felt we wanted to celebrate his beautiful life and career." Jones and her siblings took the stage after a powerful performance of "Maybe God's Trying to Tell You Something" from The Color Purple by Jennifer Hudson. Jones read from a draft of the acceptance speech her father had been working on for this ceremony before adding her own ending to it. "The real thread in his music is that his music is all infused with love," she said on stage. "That was his real legacy, love." And that brings us to the end of our time together here on the Vanity Fair Hour. Once again, you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and my name is Amy Smith, your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Thanks for tuning in. I invite you to join me next week. We'll have another full hour of stories from vanityfair.com. We'll see what's going on around the world and in politics, and of course, see what Bess Levin is writing about. Thanks for listening, and have a great week, everybody.